This is the fourth day of this October 2009 seven-day session. We'll return to the teachings of Japanese Zen master Bankei from a book called Bankei Zen, edited by Peter Haskell. We pick up in the middle of one of his talks. I can tell you something about this matter of women's Buddha mind. I understand that women feel very distressed hearing it said that they can't become Buddhas. But it simply isn't so. How is there any difference between men and women? Men are the Buddha body and women are the Buddha body too. You shouldn't entertain any doubts of this sort. When you thoroughly grasp the unborn, then in the unborn, there's no difference whether you're a man or a woman. Everyone is the Buddha body. It seems that even in Buddhist cultures, there was this notion, no doubt advanced by the monks, that women couldn't come to enlightenment. But Bankei here dismisses it just out of hand. He says, even in evil people, the unborn mind isn't missing. When you reverse their evil mind, it's none other than Buddha mind. Let me tell you how even an evil person has the Buddha mind. And then he, I'll just try to summarize this. He says, suppose two men are traveling together from here to Takamatsu. One of them is evil, the other is good, but both of them, just walking along and chatting, respond in the same way, basically, to things that come across their path. Suppose some horses or cows should come toward them. Both the good man and the bad would move aside and make their way around, even though they hadn't anticipated doing so. As they go along chatting, both of them simply move aside to get through. If there's some spot they have to leap across, both of them will take a leap. If there is a river, they'll both ford it. So he says, while you might expect that the evil man wouldn't do exactly the same thing as the good one, ducking out of the way of things, leaping ditches and fording streams without any anticipation, what he does is, in fact, no different from what the good man does. I think somewhere in his... either he or another master gives the example of people moving through a crowded marketplace and without consciously trying to figure out how to walk, they somehow find their way through one another. That image is so in my mind that sometimes it comes back to me in a crowded airport terminal where the terminals where people are walking are so wide that you have people walking in both directions on either side of the belt, the moving belt, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people. Okay, every once in a while you go left, the other person goes right, and then you have to adjust, and maybe you go right, and the other person goes left, but you work it out, and mostly you don't have those. You just thread through one another. And here Bankei would say this is the functioning of our Buddha mind, just finding our way without having to think it through. He goes on, even if your previously ingrained bad habits should lead you to attach to things that come your way so that thoughts temporarily arise, the one who is secure in his faith will neither attach to nor reject these thoughts. In the twinkling of an eye, he'll easily go right back to the Buddhahood of the unborn. Right back to one's practice, as soon as you notice a thought in the mind. Even with the Buddhas and patriarchs, it wasn't that they were completely without thoughts from the start, but since they didn't get involved with them, and, just like little children, didn't continue them any further, it was the same as if the thoughts didn't arise. That's why they remained free from thoughts. And we hear this in the Hakkawan chant, our thoughts now being no thoughts, our dancing and songs of the voice of the Dharma. Since they didn't get involved with them, and just like little children, didn't continue them any further. It's one of the many wondrous things about children is their ability to just let go of things moment by moment, like a ball bouncing on swiftly flowing water. Then as we get older, we start knitting together the thoughts and working them, and then they congeal and they get more hardened, and then we're off and running. Now, he goes on, now, when thoughts don't arise, the marvelously illuminating dynamic function of the Buddha mind won't manifest itself. So the arising of thoughts is, in fact, the dynamic function of the marvelously illuminating Buddha mind. To take something so precious as this Buddha mind, arouse all kinds of thoughts, and with them create the three evil realms of hell dwellers, animals, and hungry ghosts, so that even right in this life you're pulled along by that evil karma. It's really pitiful to think how people suffer like this, morning to night. So grasp this clearly. Realize once and for all that dealing with everything by stirring up thoughts only makes you suffer. And without switching your one Buddha mind for thoughts that are not innately yours, pass your days always in the unborn Buddha mind. So we might just to add to that, distinguish between an emotion and then the thoughts that congeal to the emotion. So there's the anger, there's the sadness, there's the impatience, whatever, and then that wouldn't be so bad. It's a little upsurge of an emotion, but then we generate all these thoughts about it and about ourselves, and that's what blocks the emotion from just passing, just running its course through the mind. It's the same with makyo. As they arise, they arise, whatever they are, and if we don't dwell on them, dwell always means think about them in some way or another, if we don't cling to them, then they just move on through. Another talk, he said, when you observe the world at large, if there's someone with a certain skill in which he excels, no matter what it is, everyone will praise him. He's really talented, they'll declare. But the bigoted person, on hearing this, will say, well, he may be good at this particular thing, but he's also got such and such bad points, thus managing to denigrate even his abilities. There's no two ways about it. That's the bigotry of the arrogant evildoer, isn't it? With people like this, if someone they're partial to has a little talent, even if it's talent no one else has ever heard of, they'll stand up alone and praise him to the skies. Bravo, they exclaim. Well done, a real virtuoso. You find lots of people like this. Isn't that sort of thing terribly wrong? We should just join gladly in praising those whom others praise, and hearing of another's happiness, we should rejoice just as if the happiness were our own. This is the way things ought to be. Such a person is an illumined person who doesn't obscure the Buddha mind. But if, in response to what you see and hear, there's any arrogance or bigotry, you change the Buddha mind with which you're endowed for a hell dweller. This, what he's alluding to here we should join gladly in praising those whom others praise, and hearing of another's happiness, we should rejoice just as if the happiness were our own. There's a word for that in Buddhism. It's called mudita. It's considered one of the four divine abodes. The other three are compassion, loving kindness, and equanimity. These four are talked about a great deal in Southeast Asian Buddhism. They build a lot of practices around them, and put a lot of emphasis on cultivating, deliberately cultivating and working with these four qualities of our true nature: compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, that's what this one is, mudita, and equanimity. In Zen, it's more simple. We just have faith that these four qualities will be liberated, will be developed through our zazen. But mudita is considered more difficult to develop than even compassion. In compassion, it's not so unusual for people, when they hear of someone else's unhappiness, suffering, to feel compassion. But to hear of someone else's good fortune, it's not so as common to rejoice in that. More common, of course, is envy or jealousy. And that comes from the envy or the jealousy comes from a sense of self and other. It's still too hard. When that begins to break down, we see that everyone is our own self. Then we just naturally find ourselves not reacting with so much envy. You know, it usually takes a while, but eventually we can find ourselves really very happy when we hear of someone else having good fortune, winning something, let's say. Now here he talks about a blind woman. A blind woman addressed the master. I have heard that one who is physically handicapped cannot attain Buddhahood. I, as you see, am blind and without the opportunity even to worship the figure of a Buddha. I feel that my being born a human has been truly in vain, and that when I die, I'll just sink into the evil paths. It's very sad, isn't it? Because she can't see the Buddha figure, that she's done for. If there's any way by which even one who is blind can be said to attain Buddhahood, I beg you to instruct me. The master replied, people do talk that way, but in the unborn I speak of, there's no distinction between being handicapped or not being handicapped. Even if you're blind, in the innate Buddha mind itself, there's not the slightest difference. Do not doubt this. Just keep clear of greed, anger, and delusion, and fully affirm these teshos I've been giving, abiding always in the unborn Buddha mind, and you'll attain Buddhahood right in this life. There was another blind woman who asked me the same sort of thing, he says. When I told her what I've said to you now, she grasped it thoroughly, and from then on she completely changed and upheld the unborn, telling me time and again, thanks to your instruction, I've now gained some understanding of the fact that I am unborn. How grateful I feel. Had I been able to see, thoughts of clinging and craving would have been roused by whatever I saw. I would have formed deep attachments, and how could this faith have appeared? Strangely enough, precisely because I was blind, I couldn't see the good and bad things of the world, so that such thoughts of attachment didn't arise, and when I heard your talk, I was able to place myself in the unborn. It's due entirely to my blindness. Well, this reminds us of the value of keeping the eyes down during sesshin. As soon as we catch sight of someone or something, we're much more likely to have thoughts spring up. And those thoughts, those initial thoughts about the sight, those thoughts tend to proliferate and take us away from the simplicity of the practice we're working on. It's so helpful to keep the eyes down and in this kind of very, very structured, intensive seclusion. Here he talks about illness and the Buddha mind. This might be timely with all the hysteria about swine flu approaching. With my only thought to find the Buddha mind, I struggled fruitlessly. He's relating back to his youth, of course. I struggled fruitlessly, floundering desperately and dashing all over. But what happened was that I got myself ill and was laid up in bed for a long time, so that I've come to know a lot about sickness too. Being born into this world and having a body, we must expect to meet with illness. But when you conclusively realize the unborn Buddha mind, you don't distress yourself over the sufferings of illness. You clearly distinguish illness as illness, suffering as suffering. This is because the Buddha mind, being originally unborn, has nothing to do with joy or suffering, the reason being that that which is unborn transcends thought. It's when thoughts arise that you experience suffering and joy. The Buddha mind doesn't attach to illness. It remains in the unborn just as it is, so it doesn't create suffering. If thoughts did arise from the place of the unborn, there would be no way you could help creating suffering, attaching to your illness, and changing the Buddha mind. So again, there's the Roshi Kaplow used to distinguish between pain and suffering. Pain, as he always used to say, is a condition of life. There is no one who is free of pain, at least from time to time. And pain takes many forms, of course, both physical, as illness or injury, and also as emotional pain. That's part of being human. It's part of being sentient. But then what really compounds the pain is when we make it self-referential, where we think about it. We think and we generate thoughts, the usual thoughts being why, and I wish I didn't have to go through this, and why do I have to go through this, and one thing after another. And that's what in I think Southeast Asian Buddhism they call suffering on top of suffering. Or we could just say suffering, as distinguished from pain. It's our making a story about our pain, with us in the middle, starring in the story. That's where we engender unnecessary suffering. If you've ever, anyone who's ever had a little injury or even sometimes illness during sesshin, knows how uneventful it can be when your mind is relatively empty. Painful, yes, but not a melodrama. He goes on, caught up in the suffering of attaching to your illness, you start thinking one thing and another. I ought to be well by now. Maybe the medicine's not right. Perhaps the doctor's no good, and so on. Clinging to the hope of recovery, you switch the Buddha mind for anguished thoughts so that the illness besetting your mind becomes worse than the original illness. It's as if you're chasing after something that's running away. Even as you gradually do recover your physical health, the mental sickness of chasing after it is gaining the upper hand. That's what's meant by attaching to things and making yourself suffer. I don't know if Bhante was aware of it, but what the scenario he just lays out is a perfect analogy for the stuff we go through in sesshin, even when we're our health is perfectly okay. So instead of I ought to be well by now, I ought to be through my koan by now. Maybe the medicine's not right, the practice. Perhaps the doctor's no good. You know who that is. It's simply the way we respond to things not being the way we want them to be. So call it physical illness, call it frustration, any kind of other emotional distress. When we're facing things, not getting what we want when we want them, how do we respond? And then he says, just go with the illness. And if you're in pain, go ahead and groan. But whether you're sick or not, always abide in the unborn Buddha mind. We would say, when he says, just go with the illness, we'd say, just become one with the aversion, the whatever it is we are unhappy about. Of course, if we can change it, then that makes sense to do that. If we're sitting in certain postural pain, pain from just some sitting, and we can make some adjustment, well, sure, do it. But when we have run out of things we can think of to do, then it makes sense just to become one with the suffering, the pain. Here he gets into psychic powers. When it comes to the idea of being free in birth and death, people are apt to misunderstand. There are some who, beforehand, announce they're going to die in a certain number of days, while others go so far as to express their intention to die, say, next year, in such and such a month, and on such and such a day. When the time arrives, some of them, even though they're not ill, die just as they said, while others put it off for another day or a month and then pass away. This is something I've never heard of in this side of the earth, but it must be something that is known, or was known there. There are lots of people who consider this being free in birth and death. Not that I say this isn't so. So far as freedom goes, they're terribly free. But things of this sort are only a result of the strength of people's ascetic practices, and often they haven't opened the eye of the way. Even among ordinary people, you frequently find this. While they may know the time of their death, they haven't yet opened the eye of the way, and that's why I don't accept this kind of thing. The person of the unborn transcends birth and death. There's a koan in the Shoyu Roku, the Book of Equanimity, that deals with this. Where a monk, probably a senior monk, presents his understanding and to the master, and the master says, no, you don't understand. And the monk says, if I don't understand, then I won't be able to die right now in the time it takes for this stick of incense to burn down. If I do have understanding, then I will die. And he lights the stick of incense, and sure enough, before the stick is burned down, he topples over dead. And then the master pats him on the back and says something like, you still don't understand. So I guess there was this idea out there, as preposterous as it seems to us, that that's some kind of attainment, some worthy attainment, to be able to die at will. But assuming that some could actually do that, so what? Yes, it means you have tremendous joriki, mental energy, power, that you can just do that through your own will. But it's not what we're after in this, the true way. He says, so what I call one who's free in birth and death is one who dies unconcerned with birth and death. What's more, the matter of birth and death is something that's with us all day long. It doesn't mean only once in a lifetime when we confront the moment of death itself. One who's free in birth and death is one who always remains unconcerned with birth and death, knowing that so long as we're allowed to live, we live. And when the time comes to die, even if death comes right now, we just die, realizing that when we die isn't of great importance. Such a person is also one who has conclusively realized the marvelously illuminating unborn Buddha mind. talking and thinking about something like what hour of what day you're going to die is really narrow-minded, don't you think? So a little bit more about this. When he says the matter of birth and death is something that's with us all day long, it's if anyone wants to know, and who wouldn't want to get some hint of how he or she would face death as we call it, if you want to get an idea of that, watch how you face loss, any kind of loss. Losing someone close to you, losing someone in a relationship, losing a job, losing a contest of some kind. It's not to say that there's no pain when we suffer, say, a loss of someone close to us. But what distinguishes someone of real understanding is the lack of clinging to the pain and the worrying about the pain before it occurs. This is what torments so many people, is looking into the future and fretting about a loss, any kind, relationship, job, money, physical ability, mental acuity. Thinking about it beforehand, obsessing about it, or doing the same while we're on the verge of that. So a lot of people in this last year, year and a half, if they knew it, people who lost a lot of money in the stock market, their retirement accounts are all, if they knew it, they would be able to get a peek into their readiness for death, physical death, by looking at how they responded to the plummeting money in their accounts. It's right there for all to see. And if there's great distress, of course there's pain. How could you not feel pain in losing savings, maybe much of a lifetime savings? Yeah, there's pain, but the question is how much you dwell in those thoughts. How much you cling to the thoughts. Or here's another one. If someone says something that someone rebukes you, someone says something that it's critical of you, a critical report, a critical response, negative, or even an insult, watch how you respond to that. Watch what happens in your body, in your mind. There it is. There it is for you to see how ready you are to die peacefully or not. These moments, and most people, I think, have these at least one every day where they have to they're confronted with something painful like that could be cause them to be defensive or angry. These are all opportunities to remind us how important it is to go deeper, to work harder on our practice, on ourself. That's the fourth of those four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes, equanimity. And it's the considered the highest of the four of compassion, loving kindness, sympathetic joy, and then equanimity. It's how, with what composure, what evenness or levelness of mind we can meet things, either fortune or misfortune, either one. That's why he mentioned joy before. That what he's talking about is kind of uncentered, wild, giddy joy. That's what is a sign of someone who's not really grounded in herself or himself. If when we things go well, we get something we wanted or we win something, if we go through any of that delirium, then there it is. That's still a sign of immaturity, because the flip side of that is going to be the misery, the grieving, or the tantruming when things don't go our way. How much more evidence do we need that we have to go further and further, endlessly further in our practice? How much more evidence do we need than these things that are being dished out to us every day? If we have our eyes open, our ears, our awareness, then we will see the signs. We'll see this evidence of the need to keep sitting, working on ourselves. Well, this seems like a good point to stop. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.